Brooke should do her American Hannah voice because it's still my favorite thing ever.
Mother. Give up your machine. Your machine is bad. Your job is for good.
Welcome back to Word of the Witnesses, our 12 Monkeys rewatch podcast. Just a reminder, this is a rewatch podcast, which means we've seen every episode from the beginning to the end, which is actually the beginning and back again. If you have not done so, please, please, please press stop now. Go back, finish the series, and come and join us on this awesome ride. This is Beep, and in just a moment, I'll be joined by Cece speaking with showrunner Terry Metalis, Christopher Monfette, who wrote the episode we're about to discuss, 407 Daughters, and our very own Hannah, Brooke Williams. Again, we just want to thank them. They are always so kind, so gracious with their time, and we just love speaking with them. And we know you love hearing them, so I will not keep you. Enjoy.
Thank you guys for everyone listening. We are recording on April 5th in the middle of an actual pandemic. And Beep and I wanted to bring some content to cheer folks up. And everyone from behind the scenes of 12 Monkeys was just so gracious and generous to give your time in the middle of all that's going on in the world to kind of keep people company at home. So we just appreciate it so much. We have with us today co-creator and showrunner Terry Metalis, the writer of the episode we're discussing today, Daughters, Christopher Monfette, and our beloved Hannah, Brooke Williams. Thank you guys so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Before we were chatting, and Chris and Terry, you all just sat down and rewatched this episode. Did you have sort of any initial reactions, sort of 2 years after it aired?
I mean, I was really impressed. I don't know about the rest of you guys, but that one was a very hard episode to me. And I was, not to toot our own horn, but I was kind of riveted from like the first 10 seconds. I don't know, Chris, what'd you think?
Well, aside from the fact that it was 2 years ago, which I think is the most disturbing thing about it I think the thing that kind of jumped out at me the most is, aside from the terrific performances in the episode was just sort of how well it's edited and constructed. I mean, the montages and the dueling voiceovers, which like you try it on the page and you hope that it's going to be effective and it's going to work, like really work beautifully. And I think it was Drew who cut this. I don't quite remember, but I think he did a really terrific job. I mean, the whole thing comes together beautifully and Steven scores it just out of the park.
Yeah. I forget if it was Drew or Chris, but it was, or maybe Drew took over from Chris, but yeah, I remember the first cut was like 20 minutes.
Yeah. There's a lot cut out of it.
And didn't have that same drive.
Yeah.
And the opening was almost exclusively Emma, was all about her life. And I remember in the first cut, you just didn't care until you saw, until we brought in Hannah. It was like, it was interesting. You're like, oh, that's cool. But then you bring in Hannah, who you hadn't seen in an episode. And you're like, oh, right. She went back in time. And then we told her story from her point of views and the dueling point of views. It came out. We also had an extraordinary amount of time to post this season. So we really crafted it. But I remember we went back and got more voiceover from Brooke and Emma. I dug it.
Yeah, it is really, the structure so elegant, that you have these, it's an episode essentially about four women, two mothers, two daughters, and all the contrasts and also in some ways similarities between them. But Brooke, this is really the first episode where we get to spend so much time alone with Hannah. And, she's got sort of two missions that her mother's given her. And the first one is to figure out how to live a life. And, when we first met Hannah, she was like this post-apocalyptic like warrior. And then all of a sudden you had to portray what would it be like to be dropped in our world. And in some ways, it reminds me a little bit of Cole in the pilot. How did you approach that sort of fish out of water performance for this episode?
I mean, honestly, that's kind of my life. Like, I'm quite alien. So, like, it wasn't a massive stretch. But also, like, you know, I understand displacement. Like, I'm from New Zealand. I'm from a relatively small city. Even coming to LA, and the first time I went to New York, I mean, I was 15 and it was wild. I couldn't believe it. And it was, everything was loud and just the sensory experience was crazy. And so, yeah, it wasn't that big of a stretch. And I guess I'd been in Hannah's life for so long at that point that I'd sort of become accustomed to that world. So just the idea of having to connect with people outside of the people that she knows so well, was, it was easy to imagine how frightening that would be. And then the writers had, well, Terry had given me some beautiful letters that the writers, I think, or maybe some of the assistants had written about Hannah in New York and that experience, sort of almost like constructed like journal entries. I think they were, in fact. And just some beautiful details about like her watching the Thanksgiving parade in New York and what that would be like. And I mean, I didn't even know there was a Thanksgiving parade in New York because I'm from New Zealand and Thanksgiving, you know, really did not mean a thing to me at that point. I didn't understand anything about really what it was. So I guess my ignorance was kind of helpful in that way. But yeah, so I was fed a lot by the writers and just by the story of Hannah's life up to that point and my own displacement in this country, I guess.
Yeah, was there any footage that we didn't see or earlier drafts or just sort of discussions between you all about what Hannah was doing during these 2 years? Because she's got a friend that she's dishing with on the phone about, give me the dirt on your date with Brian. So
initially, if this was a 13-episode order or even if we had more, you would have spent a lot of time. I mean, this is a storyline you would have spent like 2 or 3 episodes with her back at just getting there. And we had a lot of talk. I think on the Blu-ray, there's some extended scenes with her and Brian, the bartender. Mm-hmm. So you can see those. But yeah, I mean, we had a lot of discussion. I mean, we dug deep on what it would be like for a woman who was raised in the post-apocalypse to be out in society. And we talked about everything from, you know, culture to her sexuality to being a human being. And her voice kind of changes throughout the episode. If you notice, like by the, I think even in the original draft, I think Chris, maybe we pushed it even further, but she sounded like a New Yorker and by the end and had loosened up and, you know, was saying things like awesome stuff that like Hannah would never say. And I, you know, it was, so there was quite a bit we wanted to do that we didn't get a chance because of the real estate of telling the last chapter of the saga.
Yeah, and even if this had just been, say, a cable show where you had the luxury of going to 55 minutes to a cut, you know, you could have played around with that more. And I think certainly there were pages generated that did that. But I think ultimately, to Terry's point earlier, where we got to was a pretty extraordinarily well-balanced place where you would at the very least get the idea of her trajectory and her changing voice, her changing view of the world in a fairly economic amount of scenes. And like you said, on the Blu-ray, there are a couple more beats with her and Brian just sort of talking more colloquially in the world together. But I feel like what ended up on screen was really nicely constructed.
I mean, just the fact that she was using a cell phone at all was, you know, kind of gave us a look into how much she's changed.
Yeah. I mean, I wish we had spent more time with her and Brian and her meeting people in the Emerson Hotel. Again, it's one of those things where it's funny because when I watched this episode, I thought it beat it, which it all worked and was breathtaking, actually. It was one of those things where I remember there was an exec who said to me over at Universal, and I didn't necessarily agree with him, but that 12 Monkeys works best at 43 because it packs it in and you kind of, it's sort of breathless and that adds to the style and the feeling of the show, which I think I agree with. But you watch something like Tales from the Loop, which Chris and I just watched, or any streaming cable show, and sometimes I'm deeply envious of, here's 57 minutes. Do whatever you like. You wanna just have the camera on an apple sitting on a table in a sunbeam for 10, 11 seconds? Have at it. Whereas opposed to this show, we were like, fuck the apple. Well, quick, just get to the line. In fact, pre-lap the line on top of the other person's line because we got to get this thing finished because we have commercial breaks. But, you know, yes, there's a lot more we wanted to do with Hannah. Brooke, what did you want to do with Hannah that we never did?
I don't know. I guess it would just would have been it out so that we could have got some more of the nuance of the buy-in story. But I find it interesting, that nature-nurture question in regards to this, because what happens, you know, in that episode with the bar fight and stuff, I just feel like that was always going to happen, whether it was then or a week later, or because Hannah just is who she is. And like, yeah, I think she's doing the makeup thing and the pretty little dress and the hey babe, how was your date? And I think she's enjoying experiencing that. But like, there's so many versions of a modern girl in New York, and that's sort of one that she's playing with. But it would have been cool if we had have had time, I don't know, if it was an indie film or something, to really explore that transformation in terms of her exploring different identities. Because there is a version of modern New York girl that's very cool, edgy, closer to what Hannah really is and knows. And I think the version that she was trying, this sort of like cute girl, got my friends, we call each other babes, I do my makeup, put lip gloss on, is so far from who she is that she probably needed to go that far to separate herself. But then it's so hard not to come back to the nature of who you are. So I think if I had have had my, you know, ideal, if we had a million hours, it would have been to just explore her trying on different masks and finding what fit.
Yeah, maybe Hannah was like down on the Lower East Side in the indie rock scene then. I could have seen that.
Yeah.
Her sheer clothes would have fit in. I mean, one of the things I noticed just with your performance is we begin the episode and she seems a bit dazed to observing, but not participating in the world, right? She's sitting in the lobby of the Emerson Hotel. She's watching what I thought was beautifully written, how distracted we all are from the now, from the present, by our devices and everything, to then, you know, Brooke, as you said, sort of trying on that role of smiling at herself in the mirror and putting on the lipstick. But then when we see the Hannah in sort of like it flips, like flipping a switch, and we see the kind of violence that we have grown accustomed to in 2043 or 2044, but we see her do it in our world. It's shocking. You know, when she takes that jagged bottle and stabs it into someone's chest, we're used to seeing that with the daughters, but it is shocking in the bar of the Emerson Hotel.
Yeah.
When I first saw the cut of that scene, and I mean, I was there on the day that we did it, and for whatever reason, it didn't occur to me until we cut the scene together, but I just flashed on Will Ferrell and Anchorman being like, that escalated quickly. Like, you just killed a guy with a trident. It's such a brutal scene, but it she plays the switch flipping so nicely that you are reminded that for all of her efforts to blend in, who she is who she is, and she's never not been that. And so I think that scene is pretty nicely jarring.
Yeah, Brooke, do you have any previous, you know, martial arts or fighting experience before doing 12 Monkeys, or did you learn sort of all of that choreography for this show?
I had none, absolutely none, and was quite intimidated by it. But I have to say, like, it's really not my performance. I mean, some of it is, but we had incredible stunt performers. A girl, Jen Murray, I think is her last name, was my stunt double, and also was Cassie's stunt double a lot. And she was just incredible, like, not only so patient with teaching me, and Jeff Shovel was so patient as well. He did a lot of cold stunts, I think that's how you say it. But so we had a lot of support, and like, you see cut-ins of me, and we would always shoot the whole fights with the actors. But if you see anything looking really freaking slick, it's probably Jen, because she's just an incredible artist. And I was always amazed by how she could, she just took on the physical gait of the actors. Like, not even the characters, like the actors. Like when she was stunting for Hannah, she was walking around with my body language. And when she was stunting for Amanda, she was walking around with Amanda's. And they're very different. Like Amanda's been a prima ballerina. I'm like some just weirdo normal person in the world. Like I hold myself physically very differently from Amanda, and Jen just had that nuance. So yeah, she's brilliant and so talented. And I did learn a lot, but it's never been something that's been supernatural to me. So since then, I've had to do quite a lot of that stuff. I went and did a little part on another show that was like heavily, there was a lot of fighting as well. So it's just become kind of my thing, which is exciting. And it was a cool opportunity, but it was definitely not something I was natural at.
It's worth just piggybacking off of that quickly while we have the chance to praise people that, like, anybody who thinks that these stunt performers aren't giving a performance is just insane. I mean, the level of commitment and study and beyond just physical sacrifice, but the care with which Jen and Jeff, you know, studied these characters and their physicalities and actually knew the scripts and motivations and context that we've seen was fantastic. And they always did such a terrific job.
Yeah, but let's not gloss over the physical, because I remember there was a moment where Jeff got kicked in the chest in the auction episode. He was doubling. I think he was either doubling for Cole or he was doubling for one of the villains. And he got kicked in the chest and he went through he was supposed to fall into some boxes. But the kick landed wrong and just knocked the wind out of him. And I remember, you know, you're lucky to go four seasons and have it and like that. But he was like, he was down for about a minute and a half. And that was the moment I was like, yeah, this could go oh so wrong. And this is what these guys do. And he got up. I mean, Jeff was always like, I'm good, I'm good. In fact, most stunt people, no matter how gravely injured they are, will get up and be like, I'm okay. I don't know if it's the culture or I don't know what it is about them that makes them just try and walk this off. But it's, wow. I mean, to give yourself to that was so, anyway, it was very scary.
Yeah. Well, it all looks incredible. And it is a really interesting moment when you, as a viewer, when you're so used to seeing that violence in another context, and then you see it in your own, and it kind of, you know, it's scary how sort of powerful Hannah can be with her body. I want to just go back to Brooke, the nurture versus nature question, because it's something that, you know, obviously the show explored a lot in season three, but it's really interesting the way you pairs of mothers and daughters in this episode. You know, the one mother that wants to end time and her daughter is a tool versus the other mother who is messing with time to save her daughter, and all of the choices they make and how that then shapes their daughter's lives in turn. I mean, there's a lot to unpack in this episode. So when you all were thinking about spending the time for a whole episode, explore these four women and all of the connection, what were you trying to convey or explore with that?
I guess it's just the contrast is what makes this really interesting, that like there's ego and there's love. And with Jones and Hannah, I mean, my theory on it is that everything's motivated by love. And of course, ego bleeds into that at certain points. But like, even with that bar fight, I think she's protecting someone who she has very strong feelings for. And, you know, love can come out in very strange ways in the world. And especially if you are living in a different world to what you're used to. So, ego, power, versus love and where they bleed into each other, I think is interesting for both four characters and those two mother-daughter dynamics.
I think it's pretty much exactly as Brooke just said. I mean, I think this is just sort of one of those episodes where it's just defining that contrast between the two characters is so vital, and yet building that similarity as you go on, as you realize that both of these are characters who came from a place, who came from one place and one condition, having constantly thought about, you know, what would Titan be like? What would, what would the past with people in it and alive with activity and possibility look like? And then when they finally get there, finding that they're more suited to the nature of the world that they came from. And I think that similarity ultimately bonds them. And certainly later in 1 Minute More, you see the payoff of that. But, you know, I think that was the challenge in the writing of making these two fundamentally very different people going through the same universal experience.
Yeah. I mean, it also is such one of the contrasts, just picking up on what Brooke said, is, you know, the presence or the absence of love. Because mm-hmm. even if, you know, even when Hannah wasn't with Jones, she was with the daughters, she was with old Jennifer, you know, she had a family in one form earlier in her life. And then you have sort of the found family and finding her real mother, as opposed to Emma tragically being put in another box, just like her mother was put in a box. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you come to that moment where it could not become more clear as she's watching Jones be at least mentally tortured, watching Hannah die over and over again, that the contrast kind of comes to a head and reveal, you know, crystallizes it for Emma. It seems like the real turning point for her. It's an interesting exploration of sort of love, that nurture part of it. And what it does, although Emma, I have to say, like, Emma, man, she comes out of it at least trying to make a choice and trying to go down a different path, which is, you know, given her upbringing is quite something.
And I think that a lot of that is a testament to Abigail's performance. You know, she, and not, the thing with that character, the thing with Emma is you had so little time. When you really go back and you count up all the screen time that character has, she's so monumentally important to the trajectory of the story, and yet, you know, you only get precious little time with her. And so the actor in that role has to be able to carry so much, not just in terms of the performance, but the physicality. There's something about, you know, Abigail, when you look at her, that is so expressive, and that carries a lot of the weight. And so even just in the casting, you know, nailing who got that part, and knowing how much the totality of the performance ultimately has to carry so much water and so little time, we were, I think, really blessed to have her. And then, you know, and I think for these final episodes, there was a real friendship and relationship just on set that I got to see blossom between Brooke and Abigail that informed a lot of this as well. I mean, even if they weren't sharing scenes together, informed their performances and their sense of not just difference, but similarity between the two characters as eventually they meet and then move forward into 1 Minute More.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Brooke, I imagine the torture scene must have been, did you really have to film dying like 7 times in 7 different ways for this episode?
Yeah, but it was actually like 80 million times because there's like, you know, so much goes into it. But you know what? Honestly, that stuff's fun because, you know, we're pretending. Like, it has a lot of weight in the story, but like, obviously I'm not going home going, oh my God, I died so many times today. It's very physical. Like, I got to explore falling on my side in a myriad of ways, which is like, gave me some cool bruises and was very interesting. But like, you know, it's fun. It's drama. It's, yeah, those days are just, it's kind of, and you have a nice camaraderie between the actors. Like, I love Allison so much. And, you know, we'd be laughing between takes and, It looks very, it's very heavy when you're watching it because you know the context of the story and what it means. But when you're filming it, you can't, I'm not like, yeah, it was fun. That's all I've got to say, really.
you didn't take it on, is what you're saying. You didn't take it on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Because some actors totally can and will take that home.
I mean, you do take some stuff on. Like, I take stuff on if I'm in an intense drama scene. But, you know, when it stunts and you're coming in and it's like, now you're dying 80 million ways, she's going to snap your neck this way. It's very technical. And to be safe, you can't, you play the emotion of it, but you can't get lost in it. Because, like, if Allison and I are doing that, and we're not stunt performers, if she's pretending to snap my neck and I'm so out of it with my own crying bullshit, and she like snaps, you know, and we do something wrong, it's very technical. So it's different to doing a drama scene where it's something between, I don't know, me and Aaron or me and Jones, or where you might be able to really feel the weight of it. It's just another thing.
I just remember how delightfully apologetic Allison was every time she would go to snap your neck. She'd be like, I'm so sorry, I don't mean it. Like, she was just so sort of gentle and trying to be very nice about being the most evil villain ever. And it was kind of funny.
I think it's funny, like, as if I might actually think that she does mean it. But it is a weird thing. It's much harder, I have to say, when you're being the aggressor. It's really hard. Okay. I much prefer being the victim, because you have so much more responsibility as the aggressor, and emotionally it's much harder, because it's hard to pretend to kill people and hurt people. For me anyway, it's like, even talking about it makes me feel weird.
Yeah, that makes sense. One of sort of the wonderful layers to this episode, and Chris, we've chatted a little bit with you before, is it is sort of the bookend to Enemy from season three. In so many ways that I feel like you can make a list of 20 things, right? Like, now Jones is the willing captive and Olivia is the jailer. You had Hannah be the one who stopped the torture in Enemy, and now she's the tool to exploit the weakness. We go back to sort of exploring what both characters' weaknesses are, right? Because we see Olivia back in her box as Joan sort of travels through her mind. But, you know, this is Joan's, even though she's in a position on the surface of weakness, turning the tables and doing exactly to Olivia what Olivia did to her in Enemy. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't know if you had any sort of thoughts about it, because it's just wonderful flipping all of it on its head. And there's just a lot of great character stuff folded into there.
No, that was, I mean, it was just the intentionality of that was really fun to play with. I mean, as we started to break season four and kind of realize that this episode, what this episode was going to be and what it entailed, it felt like an obvious kind of fit for me to jump in and write it, because it just felt like the sequel to Enemy in so many fun ways, you know, to get to do a bottle with those two characters, but in such different places again. You know, it's such a treat, right? Because you get to reverse all of the positions of authority. You get to reverse, you know, all the kind of dynamics and roles. And then you get to play with just, you know, whereas Enemy was a lot about physical torture, this becomes a lot about psychological and mental torture. So there were so many ways in which you could complement that episode without making it feel like you were simply repeating that episode. I mean, I think this episode has a lot more kind of almost horror movie texture to it, especially in Olivia invading Barbara's mind, Jones's mind, but at the same time sort of maintaining the you know, sort of Hannibal Clarice cat and mouse vibe of just two incredible actors and characters circling each other in this kind of a combat arena in which they're both uniquely equipped.
So Brooke, and this is a little bit bigger picture than just this episode, but I was thinking about Hannah's journey and the audience's journey with her in the show, in that initially Hannah was an idea to us. So in season one, she was a name on a blanket. You know, she's that key piece of the mythology that we learn in season one and two that motivated Jones. And then you all have to bring that character to life. It's sort of in midstream of the story, where the audience has certain expectations, or there's kind of this awe around the idea of Hannah. And then you came sort of into the middle of the story. And I was just curious about sort of Chris and Terry, what you all were looking for to bring that character to life, given how important she is to the mythology, but we will learn along with the characters, really, really important to the mythology as Cole's mother, and sort of what it was like for you, Hannah, to sort of step into that role, knowing sort of, am I remembering correctly that you knew before the rest of the cast that you were Cole's mother?
I'm not sure if I knew before the rest of the cast, but I knew from when I was cast that was the idea. But
you,
like,
knew before everybody.
Okay.
So what you mean, this is, it's a character that is sort of an idea, and then we come to love her, and we are, you know,
sobbing at the end of 1 minute more when we lose her. And it's just sort of a remarkable journey that she goes on from, you know, sort of post-apocalyptic warrior to mother living in our time, sort of with her son at a distance. So if you had any big picture thoughts about bringing this character to life and kind of it's an interesting and kind of unique character, even amongst the other ones in the show.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, like, as an actor, I was kind of lucky because it's exactly what you were saying. She's so built into the mythology of the story, and that love work is already done. Like, the writers had done such a gorgeous job of creating an emotional connection for the audience with Hannah before I even showed up. So, like, that was a lot of work that I didn't have to do. So, like, my perspective on Hannah is I just think that she's so love-based, and even when her behavior is questionable, it comes from love. And so for me, that was just, I just think she cares so much. And that was really my sort of approach to it. And also, you know, you don't want to be too reverent about things. She kind of is naturally a reverent character, like she's come from this strange stoic sort of group, and so I didn't want it to be too earnest or anything. And as a person, I am quite earnest, so I do have to watch that a little bit. But I just wanted it to feel not in a sort of tacky sentimental way, but in a very real way, that like Hannah's about love. And and so I guess that's all I was sort of really focused on, because you can't play the weight of it. Like, you can't go into it going, I'm Cole's mom and I'm going to play that, because that's not what it is, you know, and that's not what it is for Hannah. So we had to be a little careful, because I knew that information. We didn't want to hit it too hard. Like, Terry, I remember you giving me a note in a scene with Cole at the beginning of season 3, not to be too admonishing of him, because it could potentially come across as a bit parental. And because the writers had already done that work for me, I didn't need to hit that. I mean, even beautiful little things like when Hannah says, may I walk with you so you don't walk alone? The audience is not looking through the same lens as me, but because I'm an actress and I know that I'm the mom, if I hit that too hard, I'm like, oh, everyone's going to know. Everyone, I'm going to ruin the puzzle. So it was just finding the balance on those things. And I mean, Hannah's such a beautiful character. I would love to play her for the rest of my life. There's so much nuance and detail that, like, you know, you always think as an actor, if I could go back, I would do this, or I would change this. But you can't, and that's kind of the beauty of it, because it's a mixture of, like, your personal chemistry, where you're at in your life at the time, what the writers have created. Character is not actor. Character is such a beautiful chemistry, or, like, potion of the actor's history and story, their creation, what the writers have made, the makeup artists, how they're costumed. It's just this beautiful kind of potion, and you just hope that it works.
I will say, though, Brooke, that, like, you know, for kind of everything you say about, you know, you come in and the writers have done a certain amount of work that you get to, that gets to sort of inform your performance, and you get to piggyback on. That's a two-way street. I mean, I was very blessed and remember you and I over the course of season 3 becoming pretty fast friends, and the amount of things that I was able to learn about you and who you are as a person and how sort of caring and empathetic and loving you are, and, you know, that little dark sense of humor that you have, like, all of that stuff does reincorporate back into the character and make it easier to then write future scenes, because, you know, it's always great when actors can act from an honest place, and to be able to find ways to work into these characters elements of the person who's portraying them was a real blessing for me as a writer. I got to do that with you and Barbara, and you know, so I think in a lot of ways, it's just knowing you as you helped us as writers find who Hannah was and continue and to give her more dimensions beyond just sort of, like you said, that abstract notion of whoever, you know, that she was presented as in season 1 and some of season 2. So that by the time, you know, you reach an episode like this, there's a lot of you informing this. And I think that's really a cool honor to have as writer, to get to to know the cast and, you know, use their virtues in terms of the writing of the characters.
That's something that I think was so cool about this show, is that you guys, the writers, I mean, were so open to doing that. And it really felt like as actors, we were being listened to, and like our personalities were being listened to. And I don't know, it's just so exciting when you get to create like that in such a collaborative way. And I think it also comes down to, it's, you know, you work on some shows and the showrunner is very far away and you go in and you do your job. But I think it was so cool on the set that it was so, everyone was there all the time. The writers of the episodes were there and Terry was there. And so it felt like you really had a sense of company. And I think it's interesting with casting too, that like from my perspective anyway, it felt like the spirit of each actor really was the spirit of the character. And that's an interesting thing too, like how much of that comes from knowing who you want the character to be and how much comes from being informed by the actor as it goes along. And I just loved it. For me personally anyway, I felt like I had an emotional connection to each of those actors that was kind of similar to what Hannah had to those characters. Mm-hmm. Like Chris, you were talking about the thing with me and Abby. I love Abby. And like, I felt very protective of her when she came on to work, and not because I needed to protect her in any way, but you know, she's relatively young and coming over from London, and I wanted to be like, you know, look after her and make sure she felt comfortable and welcome her. And then with Amanda, I have such respect for Amanda and like just love her so much. And same with Aaron. And I mean, everyone, like, you know, it's just, I don't know, the chemistry of the casting just felt so beautiful to me.
There were all sorts of little examples of that. I mean, I don't know if you recall these two specific things that happened, Brooke, while we were, and I'm not sure in what order they happened, but it must have been during or around the filming of this episode, when, I don't know if you remember that little speakeasy in Toronto underneath the bar, and there was that night where everybody was supposed to get together, but their plans kind of changed, and
yeah.
it ended up that like you called me and you were like, I'm sitting in front of all this food that I ordered and nobody's here, and I was like, okay, I'm running over from the hotel, and it was like you and I eating this whole smorgasbord and drinking, and it was like a really delightful and lovely evening, but it felt like, you know, Hannah at the bar on her own. In the 21st century, and then like a week later, and then like a week later, you know, it was you and me and Abigail. You know what I mean? Like that yeah. relationship kind of weirdly formed in the order in which it formed in the episode, and so there are always like those little moments that reflected on a personal level what was going on with the characters, and I was just really. I found it a real privilege and an honor to get to know you and Abby the way I did during this episode, and try as much as I could to incorporate those elements of yourself into the writing.
I've always felt so grateful, Chris, that you did turn up that night. I feel like I've never like properly acknowledged that, because it was so kind of you. Because I am such a Hannah, but without like the cool badass stuff. But like, I was like, I'm going to organize this thing for the group, and it's going to be so lovely. And I'm going to, you know, help everyone get together and like do this nice thing. And then one by one, everyone dropped out, and I'd already ordered all this food. And then Chris texted and was like, oh, who's all there or whatever? Or I called you, I can't remember. And I was like, oh, actually, no one's coming. Because I think you were about to potentially drop out because you had a lot of work.
Yeah, I think I was in the middle of doing a rewrite on the episode, and you texted me and you're like, nobody's here, and I'm sitting in front of all this food, and I was like, putting on my shoes now. I ran across the park because I was just like, screw it, I'll write tonight. And that was
funny. Thank you.
I just wanted to, it's interesting as you talk sort of about Hannah's relationship with different characters, because, you know, particularly when you go back and rewatch those scenes between Hannah and Cole that are both at the beginning of season 3 and the beginning of season 4, it is, I mean,
never occurred. I mean, I don't want to speak for Beat, but I know it never occurred to me that she was his mother. And yet the way you played it, she's kind of inexplicably drawn to him. You know, like if he's upset, she notices that he's upset. If he's just the way that there is that sort of earnestness and that love, even if we as the audience don't, and Hannah doesn't realize why, it's really beautiful to go back and rewatch. It kind of just makes your heart hurt in a really good way. So, you know, but I did want to ask you about Hannah and Jones, because obviously it's such a seminal relationship in the show, but it begins it's a rocky start. She hates her mother's machine, and she heard these stories of her mother as sort of this kind of Frankenstein. And by the end of the show, when you think about sort of the journey that this mother and daughter go on to when they're sitting together at the end of One Minute More, and she has watched not only in a way that could only happen on a time travel show, right? She has observed Jones with the younger version of herself and has gone through the experience. But then there's sort of the everyday that you come to understand your parents when you have children. And the love that one has for their child and how that can motivate them to do things. And so it's just really, it's a ride between Jones and Hannah. And I didn't know if you had sort of any thoughts about that, the relationship between those two characters and acting with Barbara.
I mean, yeah, it's just like, I have to say again, it's the writers doing that work. And like working with Barbara was the biggest trick. She's such a brilliant actress. I don't really need to go into that. We all know that. But like, she is also just the coolest human and the most beautiful, interesting human. And she's funny. And I don't know. I guess it comes back to what I was saying before. I had a relationship with Barbara where I had so much respect for her. And like, at first I was like, oh, she's Barbara, you know, and she's so incredible. And then you get to know someone and we have a lovely chemistry together, from my perspective anyway. I just respected her so much and her talent so much, and it was just such a privilege to be able to work with her. And so it all felt natural. It didn't feel like we really had to chart anything. And that comes down to the writing too. When it's done in the writing, you just have the absolute treat of like relying on your natural chemistry and being present with someone in the moment. But yeah, the relationship was really cool and a joy to get to explore.
Chris or Terry, did you have sort of any thoughts on sort of the dynamic that you first set up, of not really understanding one another? And, you know, they're really, especially for, in some ways, it's almost like they've been an idea to one another. And then you're in that room with that person and you may not like who they are or the choices they've made and sort of the journey you take those two characters on by the time we get to the end of One Minute More.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a little tricky because we had just introduced Hannah, and then in like the first episode where she actually speaks, she doesn't really speak kindly to her mother. And I think it's risky, right? Because you just introduced this character. How do you know, will the audience suddenly hate her, you know? And I think I remember during the live tweeting, there were people like, God, she's such a bitch. Why is she such a bitch to her mother? Which is the same shit we got for when Cassie was mad at Cole, who spent season one mansplaining his way through the potential apocalypse and what Cassie needed to do. And then, you know, leading to her fiance being burned to death. And then Cole sparing Ramsey's life, and that no one could understand why Cassie was upset at him. So it's tricky, right? Because we sit around as the writers and we were like, this is the right choice. We want conflict. We want to earn this relationship, but you can't get away from the basics of just audience reactions to a character. So I think if you're a mega hit, you have more comfort in that zone to just do what you want to do. We did it anyway, though. but you know, I watch it, and to me, it all makes perfect sense for those for those characters. But to me, it made the journey more satisfying. It's like, yeah, eventually, and by the end of that season, right, she calls her mother for the first time right before the anomalies come in and vaporize Jones. So I don't know. Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think the decisions story-wise and character-wise were all the right decisions, but it posed us a certain challenge, right, that we have to then mitigate and write around and try to overcome. And the first time I remember really being truly exposed to the challenge of their relationship was in Enemy, right, which is the scene where Brooke, I think, so beautifully gives that monologue about, you know, the doctor and her smokestack building. And you're trying to sit there and go, okay, how do I make this woman say that her mother was a monster, but like in the nicest way? like how do you have her point out that she thought her mother was a horrible Hitler-esque human being, but make it a sweet scene that the audience is going to cry at? And so there was a lot of challenges as writers sitting down to say, okay, we've made this choice, it's the right choice. How do we address this dynamic, but mitigate that so that you constantly understand where each person is coming from, and you're not just it doesn't just seem like antagonism for the sake of antagonism, and then so that you can constantly be moving it forward in a way where, even if the scene is conflicted, even if Brooke or Hannah is calling her mother out on something, you know, it's constructed in a way where you're not necessarily losing anything from that character, that the audience might go, I wish they were in a better place, but I understand that point of view, or this is conflict that will ultimately serve a better coming together down the road.
Yeah. I wanted to pick up, Brooke, on something that Terry said, just sort of about audience reaction to women. When I watched Daughters originally, I paused it halfway through and turned to my husband, and I said, I was like, oh my God, this entire episode is basically just about women. Like, in kind of shock, because you don't get, at least I feel like we don't get to see that a lot. So many complex and different women, and particularly in this episode, really driving the emotional conflict, the plot, all of it. And it's something we've asked all of your female colleagues on the show, sort of this experience for you as a woman actor, you know, sort of working today, if it was, you know, a unique experience, as a unique experience for you as it was for the audience watching.
Yeah, it's so interesting, this idea of strong female character. Mm-hmm. And I read this cool piece recently by Britt Marling, where she was really investigating mm-hmm. what that is, and what she sort of came to in it was like, I don't want to play a character, a strong female character, if it just means that I'm playing a male character in the body of a woman that men want to fuck. And I was like, oh my God, that's what it is, because so often that is the idea of a strong female character. You're just like, on the page, it could be a dude, and then you scribble it out and put a female name and cast some, like, I don't know, hot young thing, and it's like suddenly, oh, she's such a strong female character. Well done, everybody. You get the good boy award. But the thing I like about this show, and I loved and appreciated about Hannah, is it really didn't feel like that. She has a duality and a complexity to her. She has that kind of ethereal quality. She's grown up with this particular mythology and in this sisterhood, and she's grown up sort of in nature. And so there is a softness to her, as well as the toughness. She can be a lot of things, and she is a lot of things. And I felt like that was really respected. So I felt like I was being a person, and a very complex, intelligent, interesting person, not like I was playing an archetype of like, oh, I'm going to put on some leather clothes and fight some people, and I'm going to be a tough, like, strong female character. And I think that stands for all the female characters in the show. They were allowed their own voice, and that was respected and listened to. And there was complexity in all of them. And and detail and nuance. And again, that's a testament to the writing.
Yeah, I did. That was a great, that Britt Marling piece was in the New York Times, and I couldn't help but think about this show as an
it's
exception.
It's so good, huh? I just love her. I think she's so brilliant. It was such a great way of articulating something that's bothered me for a long time. And, you know, it's so contentious because it is a big thing. It's like this strong female character and people applauding each other for creating these strong female characters. And then you watch something and then, you know, so often there's an uncomfortable tension in my stomach and I haven't been able to identify what it is because I'm like, well, I guess she's strong. She's fighting all the people. She's got a gun. But just something feels off. And so it was so good to read that and go, that's what it is. That's exactly what it is. I don't want to see these pretend strong female characters. I don't want to see this token shit. It's boring and it's offensive. And it was so great to sort of be able to identify that in such a clear way. And yeah, I agree with you. I think that's what 12 Monkeys does so brilliantly. And it made me think of the show immediately too, for that reason.
Yeah. I mean, because particularly in this episode, we see all kinds of different quote unquote strength, because you have, you know, obviously Olivia's physically strong, Hannah can take down, you know, two men in 15 seconds, but you have sort of a strength of kind of inner bravery from Emma to walk away and say, I'm going to make my own choice. You have Jones have sort of the strength of her mind, you know, dueling with Olivia, like intellectually. And so there's mm-hmm. just, you know, this episode in particular is just a wonderful example because there are so many female characters, but they are all so different and exhibiting strength in such different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So Terry and Cress, this is obviously plot-wise, mythology-wise, a very important episode with old Jennifer and Deacon and having nosebleeds, and we're getting glimpses of what we now know is going to go down in Demons and in the finale. And the question people had was, number one, what specifically changed? If it's just Deacon, and I know that you guys, maybe it's just like Deacon handing the knife, but I think what the questions we're getting at is, was there another version of this loop where our heroes failed and died? And how does that not mean that Olivia then, you know, succeeded and pulled the trigger on the Red Forest? I'm not sure if I articulated that well. Does that make sense?
You did. I think it's more of a question for Katarina Jones, if you can get her on the line, or Elliot Jones. The way I always looked at it was, it is a loop. And within that loop, there are other little loops. For instance, Cassie dying in season one, yet that didn't undo the whole thing because Cole was still a component. So yes, I think there are other versions. What specifically happened in those other versions, you know, if we can get the writing staff back, we can tell you. we filled so many countless hours working out the time travel on this, knowing and working out Cole as the Djinn as a single component, but knowing that there were alternate loops that happened within the giant loop, within, you know, the Ouroboros, if you will.
I think that's right. And I mean, look, I think, you know, it was always the struggle between, and I think it's true with any time travel piece, but also especially with ours. And I think the gift we gave ourselves was really playing into the idea of loops and the idea that there is no such thing as sort of the clean line. And so I think certainly a lot of these questions are fair questions. And I agree with Terry that when you talk about the idea of sort of a loop made up of other loops, you open yourself up to any number of what ifs. And look, I would love to write 1,000 one-off episodes or comic books about sort of all of the roads not taken or what this was the first time it went around. But ultimately, I think if you sort of, to Terry's point, if you look at it from, was Cole a part of the DNA of this thing? And as long as that's true, then the main loop remains intact. You know, I think a lot of those what ifs are ultimately answerable, even though we never had the time or real estate or found it necessary to do that.
Yeah.
Got it.
I have a really dumb question that I'm going to cut because it makes me feel dumb. But it's a quarantine question. I'm like sitting here the other day going, wait, but what if? How does old Jennifer exist? Because Ramsay went back and like she's had the injection. Like I feel like she shouldn't age.
Oh, you mean Jennifer? Why does Jennifer look old?
Correct.
It's not that you don't age. You do age with the injections. I mean, Olivia's older and she's enhanced.
Okay, but old Jennifer looks haggard. Be real.
I mean, you know, lady lived out in the apocalypse for outside and for a long time. Probably did a whole lot of drugs and different kinds of sipping on the Red Sea.
She was drinking a lot of that Red Sea, yeah.
Yeah, that's not good for you.
Green tea, yes. Red tea, no. Like, that's...
Yeah, like I was watching Lethal Weapon and Gary Busey was on. I was like, oh my God, that's Gary Busey? And you're like, Gary Busey now? You know, it wasn't that long ago. 30 years. So, there you go. She Gary Busey'd.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense. Because, we'll I mean, say that yeah, the age, the but like Ramsay basically looked the same. And Olivia, you know, I mean, sure, a little here or there, but old Jennifer is like a completely different character, looks-wise.
Well, I don't know, though. It's 40. Olivia's also got different genes. I think if Ramsay, if you saw old Ramsay who lived like just, he'd be old too. I don't know.
Well, he went back for like 30 years though, right? Which is about the same amount of time from now to old Jennifer.
He's also, if I remember right, he's got the glove on and the idea that a piece of him sort of ages differently, right? Am I remembering this correctly?
Yeah.
No.
Right.
No, it's all there. Parts of him age. Somebody says that. I think when they go back in time, he's got like brittle bones and certain places.
Yeah, old man hands.
Right. So, yeah. So how do we not? So maybe old Jennifer just has the face of an old person, but she has the body of like a 30-year-old. Who knows? You know that,
right?
Perfect.
You know.
All right. Sorry to derail. I'm totally deleting that because I can.
Hey, you can keep it on.
Brooke, if you have time, I had sort of one more question because I don't know if we'll get a chance to talk to you again, and we would be remiss if we didn't ask about what is most fans, one of their most favorite episodes is 1 Minute More, and your performance is central to that. And we were just curious if you had sort of any thoughts about sort of how Hannah's journey culminates. I mean, obviously the scene at the airport and the reveal of the time that she spent with Matthew Cole and sort of culminating with that beautiful letter that you read about, you know, proud to be a daughter, but proudest to be your mother. And that final scene with the Jones family, it's a lot emotionally to watch. So we would just love to hear sort of your experiences filming, you know, the end of Hannah's journey.
Yeah. The writing really did a lot of that work. I think suddenly Hannah makes sense to herself is my perspective on it. Like everything that she's been through and all the confusion and all the craziness suddenly makes sense and Cole. And I'm not a mother myself, but I can imagine that changes things so dramatically when you have a child. And I think it comes down to as well what I was talking about before. It's love and it's sacrifice. And that this crazy, wild child, feral, sweet, sad creature has like found her purpose. And it, unfortunately, or fortunately, I mean, it's sad, but it's also noble. And I think she's settled in herself. That's what I felt anyway in that episode when I was creating it. You know, creating my performance on it, like that there's something that's been restless in her and wild that felt tamed is the wrong word, but like settled, like a peace, I suppose, even though it's, you know, it's bittersweet. But I wanted to subtly create more of a feeling of groundedness in her.
Yeah, that definitely comes across in that scene where you don't realize that Hannah is trying, you know, she's talking about Marion Woods, but who she's really talking about is herself, saying she was lost and trapped between two worlds. And now when you go back and watch it, knowing that she knows all that she knows and what she's about to go do, it's a lot.
It's sad.
Chris and Terry, do you have anything to add? Because this is, you know, 1 Minute More is such a, I think you all have heard now how much it means to audiences, but you know, Hannah is such an important part of that.
We should all come back for that one. because there's a lot.
Yeah.
A lot to say that. I mean, if Brooke is avails, tech avails. But the
you guys are not super busy, don't lie.
None of us are.
Can't even make up an excuse at this
point. Actually, Chris and I, our days are filled right now. I think in some ways we'd rather just be quarantining with all of you, but we're like technically in this writer's room right now, doing it virtually, and it's challenging to do. Anything to add? I mean, so much to add. But I do think before we end this podcast, Brooke should do her American Hannah voice because it's still my favorite thing ever.
Mother. Give up your machine. Your machine is bad. Love is so good.
There is a really tiny comical moment when you are not really Hannah, but you are Olivia's projection of Hannah, and you have that like awkward smile, like it's me, but it's not really me, and it is so funny. Like you're like,
it's so funny. I don't know why I did it like that. Honestly, so but great. I think it's funny.
It's so good.
I was just having a bit too much fun with it, I think. And then when I watched the episode and saw everyone else being her, I was like, oh, they went for subtle, and I really didn't.
But it's funny, but it's also kind of a little creepy, you know, so it does, weirdly serve the scene, you know, like it kind of works perfectly.
Yeah,
funny but mildly creepy. That's fine.
It does become like the obvious cue that it's like this is not right.
It's Olivia playing with like a Hannah doll, and Olivia doesn't know how to emotionally connect.
That's what I was trying to do, but I think I hit it a little hard.
It's perfect. It's
a fun moment.
It's so great. Brooke, well, we would love to have you back for the episode that broke all of our hearts. Are there any upcoming projects that you have that we can look forward to seeing you in?
No, just like videos from my living room if you want to follow me on Instagram. I don't post stuff like that, so that's not even true.
You should though.
No. I know. Please. I'm too self-conscious. I'm not cool enough. I'm too awkward.
I think we all just need to start a show. We can talk about whatever we want.
Yeah.
I would love to come back. Thank you so much for including me. It was so lovely.
Yeah, thank you so much, Chris and Terry. Thank you for being.
No, thank you. This was fun.
Very pleasure. So do you guys have any, before we go, we're all stuck at home, anything that any of you have watched that you would recommend? Because we all have a lot of time to watch things.
Go ahead.
I watched Netflix. I watched all of Netflix. I highly recommend all of Netflix. whether
two
it's,
shows.
Yeah, I think Tara's going to say one that I agree with wholeheartedly.
Tales from the Loop on Amazon's pretty amazing. Or at least I saw the first episode. I was very jealous of. And Devs were both. I'm not caught up, but I've been enjoying that on Hulu or FX. What else you got? Oh, Tiger King. I mean, guys, Tiger King
is. And I will say this, and I've been saying it to Terry with probably over enthusiasm. I'm really kind of loving Dispatches from Elsewhere. I feel like it's not getting any recognition or praise, but
I don't even know what it is.
It's Jason Segel's show that he developed.
Right.
AMC, and it's kind of like a piece of it's basically about five characters who all get drawn into this piece of interactive theater that they are not quite certain whether it's real or not, but it's
cool.
Sally Field is in it, Jason Segel's in it, Andre 3000 is in it. It's got this great cast, and it's kind of delightful and whimsical, and enough people aren't talking about it because I think it's really clever and fun and emotional and witty and weird, and I'm really digging it, and I highly recommend it.
Got it. Brooke, how about you?
I'm super into Devs at the moment, same as what Terry said, and also my friend gave me a subscription to MasterClass, which is pretty amazing. I've only watched two so far. We're talking about it before you guys all jumped on, but I've watched the Margaret Atwood Introduction to Creative Writing, which was just so cool, and a makeup one. But I'm really excited for the cooking one because I'm hoping that I might be able to take some of this time to become a better cook. So lots of new skills possible.
Guys, want to know something really interesting? Sure. Nina here has met Carol Baskin.
Wow. How?
Oh, God. I feel like a horrible person. So one time, the summer before last, I was down. My parents have a place in near Sarasota, and there was red tide, so you couldn't go to the beach. And I have three kids at that time, 9 and under. And so my husband and I basically went to every single aquarium or animal park or zoo that you could go to in a week. And we went to the big cat, that the place in Tampa. And it is, I mean, we're just watching. I've only watched the first two episodes. The way the last one ended, I was like in the fetal position that I can't believe we went to this place and I have pictures of my kids with like the tigers. It's a lot.
But so wait, how far did you get in Carol Baskin's story? Is it the third episode where they reveal the twist?
There's a teasing at the end of this episode about what might have happened to her husband. And so
they've reopened that investigation, by the way.
You have to know that, okay? I haven't watched a single episode, and like every single detail is all over the internet.
I was super resistant to it. My husband just was like, holy shit, we were there. And so we went back and found all the pictures and we were like, oh my God, we saw her give a talk. And we
how do you end up there? Isn't it, where is it? Georgia? Where is it? Like, Tampa. How do you go there? Like,
there's two of them. Yeah, there's Tampa and Sarasota. And so if you are at the beach and can't go to vacationing. The beach. Yeah, we could have red tide. You can't even walk on the beach because you can't. And like the air makes you cough and makes your eyes sting and little kids can't be on the beach. And so we were just like stuck there for a week. And I mean, we went to like my kids love animals. So I thought it was a place where they rescue, like Fish and Wildlife sends animals there. So it's a quite disturbing and personal journey for us as we watch Tiger King.
I'll say this about Tiger King. If Terry and I went and pitched this story with these characters to any studio or network, they would be like, you're fucking crazy. That's too written. This is impossible. It's like the most wild story I've ever seen. It's insane. Like I'm loving it.
It's even crazier than like a Wes Anderson movie.
Yeah.
I'll try, and we're trying to dig photos from the actual show, from the actual like talk that they gave. We have to go to her because I don't know if I have a photo of her or not. It's really disturbing. I'm gonna have to really think through where I take my kids in the future. All right. Well, guys, thank you so much. Thanks for making the time. I don't know about you guys. Things like this, giving people something to look forward to right now, it means a lot. So we really appreciate it.
No, of course. Thank you for having us. And I'm looking forward to coming on and talking more about future episodes.
Yes. All right. Take care, everyone. Stay healthy.
You too.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Yep.
Bye-bye.
Thank you again to Terry, Chris, and Brooke for keeping us company on this episode. They were fantastic and we're so excited that they chose to spend their Sunday morning with us during quarantine. Make sure to join us back for the next episode for Demons. We will have Terry Metalis, Sean Shredda, Allison Down, and Todd Stashwick. So I imagine that one's going to be a bit wild. Until then, everybody stay safe, and we'll see you soon.